Hello, everybody. My name is Ella. I have a sleeping baby at the back. So this is a real test as to whether he can tell his mother's microphone voice. I'm hoping it doesn't wake him up, but if you hear a scream, we've all proved that that experiment works. So a few trigger warnings. I'm going to touch on all of these things very briefly, nothing graphic or hopefully too troubling, but they're really sensitive topics for anybody for any number of reasons. So if you want to rush out, please don't feel bad about it. So, as I said earlier, my name is Ella. This is my second time at EMF, and I know I'm up against laser cutting and hydroelectricity, so it means quite a lot that you've come to this talk and listen to me share my story. So, my name is Ella. I'm an engineer, a project manager, a business owner, a speaker, an associate lecturer, a volunteer, and a very proud STEMinist. And this is like the standard introduction I've been using for a few years with all my talks and all my presentations. But as of November last year, there was a notable omission. My name's Elle, and I'm a parent. I'm a mother, I'm a mum, I'm a mummy, I'm a mama, I'm a mimi. And back in 2022, I stood up on this stage, but at that end, and did a talk called An Engineer's Guide to Grief, which was going into the lessons that I learned from the death of my partner in my 20s, and how much it had in common with the laws of thermodynamics. Did anybody come to that? Whoa, that's mad. Honestly, I've got like ad lib here, and it's because I thought there's literally no one that's going to come to this. So thank you very much for returning, because I appreciate quite different ends of the spectrum. But arguably the only two things that we all experience, even if we're not really aware of either of them. So yeah, thank you. So this talk is very much a similar format, and it is a chronic use of a metaphor to describe a big life experience. So a little disclaimer first. Everyone's experience of pregnancy, birth, parenthood is utterly unique. So this isn't a one-size-fits-all, how to get your kid to sleep through the night kind of talk. He woke up three times last night, so I am not qualified to give that talk. But it's also true of engineering solutions as well. Everything starts with physics that underpins the engineering. Science gives us those basic formulas to start solving a problem, but each situation is different, and that's why we need engineers and scientists. Who here would identify as a scientist? Who would identify as an engineer? Ooh. Who? Anybody identifies as both? Oh, cool. Nice. Okay. So there's one final little housekeeping thing before I fire up this metaphor machine. I feel like in this field, there's a lot of like-minded technology enthusiasts / capitalism critics. I feel like this is quite a safe space, and it probably isn't a very unique stance. But my partner and I are keeping our little human off the internet for as long as possible. So I'm going to refer to him as Little Apple for this talk and its inevitable posting on YouTube. And that is the first of my Newtonian references. So way back before thermodynamics, we had Sir Isaac Newton and his laws of motion. He was a self-described polymath. He was active as a mathematician, a physicist, an astronomer, an alchemist, a theologian, and an author. And actually, when I was researching this talk, I've come to the conclusion that he actually produced as many really good quotes as he did equations. So I'm going to pepper some of those into this as well. The definition of a polymath is an individual whose knowledge spans a substantial number of subjects, and they draw on complex bodies of knowledge to solve specific problems. And Newton wasn't a parent. He was actually quite probably the opposite. It's widely thought that he actually died a virgin. However, I think being a polymath would really set him up very well as a parent. It's like non-stop drawing on these complex bodies of knowledge, but they're tiny little knowledge bodies, and they're totally unique to you. And we're always solving very specific problems as parents. And I think it depends on your where you are in the journey of parenthood. It could range from how to survive mourning, sickness. And that is something that really needs a rebrand. That is not restricted to the mourning. And I can highly recommend Haribo Sour Sparks, if anybody is in that part of parenthood. And through to right now, we are learning right now about how to survive a festival with a six-month-old, which has definitely spanned a number of substantial topics in the last 3 days. So Newton's laws of motion were first set out in his Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, and it was published in 1687. These laws describe the relationship between the motion of an object and the forces acting on it. Limitations to Newton's laws have been discovered. I feel like in this room you probably all know this bit, but newer theories are necessary when things move at very high speed. You have some special relativity, they're very massive, general relativity, and very small, where we need some quantum mechanics. But for the purposes of this talk, we're going to stick to middle of the road, classic, run of the mill, first term, first week of your engineering degree kind of stuff, which brings us nicely to the first law. Translated from Latin, Newton's first law reads, every object perseveres in its state of rest or of uniform motion in a right line, except insofar as it's compelled to change that state by forces impressed thereon. Newton obviously had much bigger lungs than me to make that one sentence. But in modern English, an object remains at rest or at motion in a constant speed in a straight line until it's acted on by force, inertia. After qualifying for an engineer and then chasing racing cars around the planet for, to be honest, too many years, starting a family wasn't something that was particularly at the forefront of my mind. In fact, it was something I think I'd quite actively pushed to the back. Cutting it in a fast-paced, male-dominated industry, often thousands of miles away from home, just didn't seem compatible with nappies or nap times. And I was worried about bringing a little apple into a world increasingly divided by politics, by culture wars, by actual wars, a fragile economy, social securities lacking in resources, onto a planet on fire in literally every sense of the word. And the more parents I speak to, I think that's a concern that a lot of people have had. Perhaps Newton had a crystal ball when he was looking at 2023 when he said this. I can calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. Perhaps he was looking at our current government, I don't know. I was absolutely terrified that I wouldn't know what to do with a small, helpless human. They quite famously don't come with an instruction manual. And I couldn't go away and absorb myself in a textbook and practice papers. I couldn't get chartered parent status and be assured that I wasn't going to rot my little apple. As an engineer trained in logic and reasoning and factors of safety, that was my biggest fear. It was much closer to home than kind of my public professed concerns about the climate crisis and the rise of populism. I wasn't a girl that played mummies and daddies in the playground. I never doodled a future husband's name on my exercise book as a teenager. My ovaries never provided the promised broodiness that I'd read about in Marie Claire magazine in my early 30s. Unless you count an intense desire to really snuggle every cat I've ever seen, like, I don't think I had an obvious maternal instinct. And as it turns out, maternal instinct probably isn't a thing. Or if it is a thing, there's actually a lot of research now that shows it peaks between the ages of 3 and 5. I was definitely playing with dinosaurs and not dolls at that point. So without this maternal instinct or this manual, I just wasn't sure that motherhood was for me. I'd been so certain a Newton-esque force was just going to appear and take me from my constant speed, straight line of travel through my life and through my career and just knock me into this path of parenthood. But it hadn't. But another important understanding of the first law is that when there's two observers, there isn't a way to see which one is really moving and which one is really standing still. One observer's state of rest is the other's of uniform motion in a straight line. And in an experiment, you can't tell which one is which. The no point of view is either incorrect or correct. So perhaps I was moving towards becoming a parent after all. Perhaps my state of rest was actually my uniform motion. Perhaps I couldn't prove it either way. And perhaps it wasn't a binary choice between it being correct and incorrect, parent or family, career or family, family or career. And either way, when two blue lines appeared on a pregnancy test, inertia began to well and truly take hold. So Newton's second law of motion is that of force. The change of motion of an object is proportional to the force impressed and is made in the direction of a straight line in which the force is impressed. A slightly shorter sentence from Mr. Newton there. To put it more simply, the acceleration of an object depends on the mass of the object and the amount of force applied. The change of momentum of a system divided by the time over which it changes. And we're incredibly lucky to be stood in a country with a free at point of use healthcare system. And when I started writing this talk, I thought I was going to keep it apolitical. And then this happened. So, I'm also, when I wrote this, wrote our current Prime Minister, and now, as we've dissolved Parliament, I'm a bit confused as to whether he is the Prime Minister or whether we have no Prime Minister. So if anybody is more politically savvy than me, please let me know at the end as to whether, I hope, well, I don't hope he's the Prime Minister. But I think, like, we need a Prime Minister in case something happens between now and the 4th of July. But anyway, this is Rishi's proud little face 2 weeks ago. So what he is grinning whilst holding is a frankly devastating report into the epidemic levels of birth trauma experienced by women and birthing people up and down the UK. So I decided to change my mind about this section, and we are going a bit political here. So this report found that 30,000 women a year experience birth trauma, with 1 in 20 going on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. 30,000 women a year. I'll caveat this by saying I'm not one of those women, thankfully. You know, by what a more faithful person would say is the grace of God. But perhaps also a little bit tinily by accident, by instinctively behaving a bit like an engineer. As I mentioned before, my first appearance at EMF was all about death and grief. Caring for my late partner was one of the most profound privileges of my life. But the thing that I took away most from that experience was the importance of advocating for yourself and for your friends and for your family, and obviously, quite clearly, for your child. So whether you're birthing new life or saying goodbye or just merely existing in an underfunded, overstretched NHS, you must understand that you have force and you must not be afraid to use it. The NHS is enormous. Every trust is its own organisational juggernaut. Individual departments, whether it's oncology or maternity, are weighty enough on their own. So when you're faced with such a big mass, it can feel like you'd need an impossible amount of acceleration to change its direction. But please know that you can. So from my first booking in call with my local maternity team, I just felt utterly swept up in not excitement, but in a system. One full of jargon, acronyms, statistics, briefly cited studies, and appointment after appointment after appointment. At 36, I was kindly labelled a geriatric pregnancy. Lovely, isn't it? And I had too high a BMI, a thing created by not even a doctor in the Victorian ages to describe old white men. But apparently, that meant I needed to have more appointments. I was put under what's called consultant-led care, meaning that for every appointment with a midwife, I basically had another with a doctor. And some people might find that really reassuring, but for me, it was really, really overwhelming. And at 24 weeks, that got a lot more complicated when I failed what's called a glucose tolerance test, and I was diagnosed with what's called gestational diabetes. If you are not familiar, it's quite Ron Seal. It is what it says in the tin. You become temporarily diabetic during your gestation, a lovely agricultural word that again makes you feel really good about your gestational geriatric state. I did feel all blooming and lovely throughout my pregnancy. So a hormone that's actually produced by your placenta prevents the body from using its insulin in the way that it would normally do. And it actually affects 1 in 20 pregnancies in the UK. And that's not the first time we've heard 1 in 20 today. 1 in 20 experience PTSD, and 1 in 20 get gestational diabetes. But the difference is that for gestational diabetes, unlike maternal PTSD, there is a clearly signposted, well-trodden pathway of care. It's not quite a straight line of motion, but that test result provides a force that does instantly propel you into this like totally different line of travel. There's more consultants, testing, scans, appointments, finger pricks, studies, guidelines, and a lot of stress. And I wanted to engineer my way out of gestational diabetes. And when you search that online, the headlines are stillbirth, there's shoulder dysocia, which is where babies get stuck on the way out, and just sumo-sized newborns. And when you get your test result at 7 p.m. on a Friday night, I think the midwife thought she was being really helpful, phoning me on a Friday night at 7 o'clock. But you actually, what she did was she gave me a bonus 48 hours to panic Google search absolutely everything I could before I could actually meet the specialist on the Monday. So that weekend, I trawled NICE guidelines, World Health Organization advice, Cochrane reviews, anything that like my empirical, evidence-loving engineering brain could grasp onto. And as I tried to backwork statistics and like grade qualities of studies, what became apparent was that this line of motion for gestational diabetes that I was being accelerated on was really based on very tiny data sets. Studies in the 70s and really outdated advice in a lot of ways. But this is a system with momentum. It's got increasing momentum. More and more birthing people are given a GD label every year, and that could be a whole, like, another half an hour talk. And the number of registered midwives is actually decreasing at a very similar rate. So the care quickly becomes very, very homogenous and anonymous. But it doesn't have to be. And I knew in my heart of hearts that the standard pathway for gestational diabetes wasn't right for me or for little Apple. I didn't want to be induced under the watchful room of consultants in a hospital where I'd said my goodbyes over a decade before. Little Apple, he didn't grow into a big NYC sumo apple after all. So I decided to put some of my own force back onto the system. UK human rights law gives you the right to make your own choices about your maternity care. They state that healthcare professionals must provide care and they must respect your dignity and freedom to make decisions about yourself. And the landmark Montgomery ruling also means that a birthing person is entitled to a personalised conversation about risks and benefits of any options they're considering. They should be given information about risks that are important to them as an individual and to support them to make their decisions about their own care. Hospitals can't legally rely on giving you a printed leaflet and bunging you off to a website, and more people need to know that. You know, they must give you a personalised discussion between any individual and a healthcare professional. And if you ask specific questions, you must be given honest and objective answers. And learning about this and reading all those studies, I decided to apply for what is really, again, quite patronisingly called an out-of-guidelines birth. Way to, again, make me feel really good about myself. I had a load more appointments and a load more calls, and I think there was a possible growing realisation from my doctors that I wasn't going to give up and do what I was told. A new personalised pathway was agreed between me, my partner, my fantastically supportive community midwife, and the fairly unimpressed obstetrician that definitely didn't like the gobby engineer girl. Ironically, for all my meticulous planning, little Apple decided he needed to drop before any of us were ready, and at quite short notice. And it wasn't a glorious miracle of nature kind of moment. There was a lot of swearing from both me and from the anaesthetist. But thankfully, I'm not in the 1 in 20 with PTSD, and the 1 in 20 that we have very little in the way of a system to support. And I think in a small part, that was because I'd built in these small factors of safety within what I could control, within my rights, and that gave me space to survive what I couldn't. And you have a lot more in control than you think you have. And I'm not saying that birth trauma is just preventable by simply applying for an out-of-guidelines birth and making a playlist and getting really shouty. That's absolutely not the case. Birth trauma is deeply complicated and often really unexpected. But when you read through the testimony in Grinning Rishi's little review, you know, lack of personalised, person-centred care and feeling hopelessly, helplessly forced through a solar system, starved of resources, comes up again and again. And if you look at a lot of similar studies about healthcare for children and that thing, it's the same. It's about not being listened to. So I'm not telling you this because this is a rallying cry against the NHS. It is not. But I truly believe that acknowledging that you are giving birth in a system with its flaws and its contradiction, but also with actually a lot of compassionate professionals who are also stuck in a policy forest and this web of processes with you. But by doing your own research, questioning the status quo and advocating for yourself loudly and unapologetically for your body and your birth and your baby, you can build in these small factors of safety. And I wish we didn't have to, but where we have the privilege to do so, we owe it to ourselves. And also, be careful who you vote for. So if you take nothing away from this talk, please remember that you have enshrined in law the force to change the motion of your care at any point for any reason. And that's not just in maternity. But just knowing that, even if you don't apply it, can make all the difference. So as Newton said, live your life as an exclamation rather than an explanation. I love that. I feel like that should be on more t-shirts than him sitting with an apple bopping on his head. So his third and final law almost too beautifully sums up where I am right now. If two bodies exert forces on each other, these forces have the same magnitude but opposite directions. You can tell he's getting bored because that sentence is like a third of the size of the first one. The fourth trimester is now over. Little Apple has just turned 6 months and I'm heading back into the real world, except I now have this undeniable, unescapable force always pulling me back. A tiny, tiny, powerful tractor beam of illogical, unexplainable love. Overly brief paraphrases of this law, like action equals reaction, I think confuses every generation of student engineers. But the action and the reaction can apply to different bodies, and the mutual action of two bodies upon each other are always equal, but they're directed into different parts. So prior to becoming a parent, I hadn't realised that we weren't born with a sense of self and identity. And I know that I've just said that in a room full of scientists and engineers, and I appreciate how stupid that sounds. There's quite a lot going on with getting out of a warm world where everything is plugged in into this world of harsh lighting and having to breathe and eat. But I genuinely thought he was going to pop out and understand who he was and who I was, and you know, we'd immediately move on to the kind of bonding stage. But actually, it's only now, as he approaches 7 months, that he has any idea that him and I are not one joined entity. And I find that endlessly fascinating. And it's only at that point, where he is now starting to understand that we are separate beings, that I am now going to leave him to return to what I am now always going to refer to as paid work, because sweet baby Jesus, childcare is work. For anybody that goes, oh, maternity leave, a little holiday, they haven't done it, have they? A Grand Prix weekend is so much easier than 48 hours with a newborn. the Newtonian force that I was searching for at the very beginning is now so strong. I don't think I can ever engineer this bit away, and I don't want to. I can't return to a straight line of motion through my career, and I don't actually want to do that either. Mum guilt is a thing, but it's a bit like morning sickness. It needs a rebrand. It's dad guilt, it's carer guilt, it's grandparent guilt, it's best friend guilt, pet owner guilt, and everything that is not paid work guilt. We all have all of these extra forces on us, totally understandable reactions all the time. We've been conditioned to keep them quiet, fight them under the desk in an office, and by logging on after bedtime. But I've made a promise to myself and to little Apple that I'm going to parent out loud. So that's putting his needs into my calendar, not just as unavailable, but making it clear that I am unapologetically not online. I'm leaving on time, but not to beat the traffic, you know, but to give my baby a cuddle before bed. I'm hopefully then giving myself and the other people that work with me permission to react in the opposite direction wherever, whenever needed. You know, it's all well and good having family-friendly policies in your work handbook, but actually just all being a little bit more honest about whether they've been up all night or whether they need to get home for bath time, I think is the change that we need now we've got the pieces of paper in place. Little Apple is a little bit too small to understand what I'm doing when I'm not doing like this best kids TV presenter thing, jumping about in front of him all the time. But when he's old enough as well, I'd like to engineer out loud as well, so he has an understanding about why I love what I do. And hopefully bringing him to EMF is part of that. So until that time comes, and so I don't dissolve into a puddle of tears and parent guilt every morning before work, I've got a new mantra penned by our friend Sir Isaac. What we know is a drop, what we don't know is an ocean. Little Apple is just a little drop at the moment, and one day he'll be an ocean. And I don't know what he'll become or what he'll be capable of doing. But I do know that with a happy parent fulfilled and refilled by the world outside of the four walls of his bedroom, he'll be an ocean rich in experiences, possibilities, and most of all, love. Thank you.